intruding drone. This scenario was part of the last phase of a large-scale military drill held over an area stretching from the Strait of Hormuz all the way to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
The drills cover a 3 million square kilometer area. They aim to test the preparedness of our young personnel and our military equipment that have recently been added to our fleet. Our military might send the message of peace and friendship to our neighbors, but to our enemies, it's a show of power and deterrence.
The three-day maneuvers saw the deployment of several pieces of domestically built equipment, from drones and missile systems to warships, submarines, and tanks. The country has been building up its defense arsenal against the backdrop of the West's arms embargoes on Tehran. The army says today it is capable of protecting the country's land, air, and sea borders using locally developed hardware.
All of the systems used in these maneuvers have been developed domestically. They are designed to hit targets at different altitudes. These exercises show that we, as the Air Defense Force, along with other branches of the army, are fully capable of defending our country using military technologies that have been fully developed domestically.
The Army's Air Defense Force also used its Mersad missile systems to strike hostile air targets. The Army says it's working on more advanced missile systems to further bolster its deterrent power.
The naval drill engages all of the four branches of the Iranian Army, including its Air Defense Force, which has deployed its latest homegrown missile systems. The Army says this is to boost synergy between its different units, to be ready to confront any potential threats to its territorial waters. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
The Center for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized roundtable focusing on the fight against terrorism and extremism in the West Asia region. Guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies took part in the forum, which concentrated on efforts made by the Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Among the most significant topics discussed during the meeting were fighting terrorism in the West Asia region from the point of view of international law, the role of General Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the West Asia region, and the role of the United Nations in fight on terror in the West Asia region. On the sidelines of the meeting, Iran's former ambassador to Iraq, Iraj Masjidi, highlighted the late commander's role in neutralizing terrorist groups in neighboring countries.
When Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, I was working as the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Iraq. He would frequently travel to Iraq in order to confront the ISIS terrorist group and help the Iraqi armed forces and Hashd al-Sha'bi with planning and logistic support. In other words, he played a prominent role in Iraq in the fight against terrorists.
Masjidi also said that efforts to bring a prosecution against those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani continues. In this regard, the head of a special Iranian committee tasked with pursuing the case of General Soleimani's assassination in domestic and international courts said an indictment on the assassination will be announced soon. He was referring to a report by a UN expert on extrajudicial killings concluding that the targeting of General Soleimani and those accompanying him constitute an arbitrary killing for which the U.S. is responsible.
Iran has had a significant role in the fight against terrorism in the West Asia region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. And Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, played a pivotal role in combating terrorism and defeating Daesh. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next, all bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which are never really talked about. But Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the prime ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and the prime minister just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes, and I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year, a 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
South Korea plans to significantly boost military spending over the next 5 years, an annual increase of nearly 7%. The Eastern Asian country aims to spend over $440 million on anti-drone weapons alone. The announcement comes only days after North Korea flew drones into the South's territory for the first time in 5 years.
According to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Monday, five North Korean drones crossed the border before breaking formation. Four of them headed to islands in the West Sea, while one of the drones continued south, reaching the skies over the outskirts of this city, the capital, Seoul.
It was the first such incident since 2017 when a drone crossed into South Korea and photographed a U.S. base here. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, a conservative who came to office in May of this year, has blamed the previous progressive government's policy of engaging Pyongyang for the recent incident.
Given that efforts or military training to respond to such UAV drones have never been properly done since 2017, I think our people must have well seen how dangerous a policy relying on the North's good faith and peace agreements would be.
South Korea plans more joint military exercises with the U.S. for 2023, although much of the public wants talks with North Korea and a de-escalation of tensions. Meanwhile, North Korea has unveiled new goals for the country's military. Addressing a large committee meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, leader Kim Jong-un indicated on Wednesday that the country will continue its military development in 2023 after a record year of missile testing. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's far-right government is about to adopt a security decree that will introduce a compulsory code of conduct for NGO-run ships rescuing asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea. Since day one of its mandate, the Giorgia Meloni government has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what it calls irregular migration. The new measures will force NGO-run ships to deliver rescued asylum seekers to port immediately, without waiting to pick up more people at sea or transferring asylum seekers to larger vessels. Under the new rules, rescued people will also have to apply for asylum in the country where the NGO-run ship is flagged in. Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Piantedosi has said the new provisions aim to prevent organized campaigns to transport asylum seekers departing from Libya and other countries to Italy.
We asked if the migrant issue would be the main focus of the next year's opening council of the EU ministers' meeting. The EU needs a serious and constructive approach on the matter in order to draw a clear distinction between asylum seekers and irregular migrants.
According to the Italian government, saving lives at sea has contributed to increasing migration, and while some NGO ships genuinely carry out rescues, others engage, quote, in systematic searches for people in cahoots with migrant traffickers. Humanitarian groups have warned that the government's measures will stop them from saving lives.
Bisogna informare.
People departing from Libya and other countries for Italy must be immediately informed by the media about the risks they would face by crossing the Mediterranean Sea, so that they can reconsider their decision. The best-case scenario for them is to end up in a detention center in Libya. It's hell for people in there.
Over 90,000 people have arrived at Italy's ports this year. Rome has been stopping many NGO-run ships from docking in the country, on one occasion sparking a diplomatic rift with France after an NGO-run vessel flying the French flag was denied entry. Italy's policies on the migrant issue have been strongly condemned over the years. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal authorizes Italy and the EU to help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence, and abuse are practiced. That deal today is still in place. Max Civilli, Rome.
Brazil is less than a week away from Lula da Silva's return to the presidency, and preparations are underway for a massive festival in Brasilia, which will be held alongside the official events. Tens of thousands of members of social movements and Lula supporters from around the country are preparing to travel to the capital, many of whom will be camping out to celebrate the new government at the Festival of the Future, for which dozens of Brazilian artists have confirmed their performances. There is both a sense of excitement and tension as protests against the incoming government by supporters of outgoing Jair Bolsonaro are expected. Despite multiple thwarted plots, called terror plots by the incoming government, people are determined to make their way to Brasilia.
I'm going to Brasilia from Sao Paulo to be there for the inauguration of our president Lula, who will be there, which is very satisfying and makes me proud. and I'm also looking forward to participating in the celebrations and festivities of the social movement.
I'm heading to the inauguration of our president, Lula. I want to be with him at the festivities, singing and supporting him because there are so many good things to happen in our country.
The presidential transition is advancing, and President-elect Lula has been making known some of his ministerial appointments. Among the most notable are singer, songwriter, and actress Margarith Menezes, who will take on the role of Minister of Culture, and lawyer and writer Silvio Almeida, who serve as Minister of Human Rights. Lula's former environmental minister, Marina Silva, will take another turn heading the ministry. Sources close to Jair Bolsonaro say that he will not be handing off the presidential sash to Lula da Silva and will be taking an extended holiday at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in the United States. Camila Escalante, Sao Paulo.
Lebanon's economic meltdown is about to enter its fourth year with additional afflictions in its trail. Although the country could finally hold the much-awaited parliamentary elections, it entered the trap of a presidential election stalemate.
With the mindset and the mentality of many of the Lebanese politicians, I think it's a very difficult process. You mentioned the Lebanese forces. It's known the Lebanese forces have this blind hatred and ideological demonization of other parties, first and foremost Hezbollah. This facilitates the intervention of foreign parties like Saudi Arabia, who are said to put a veto on certain presidential candidates.
The year 2022 was not all towards a downfall for Lebanon. The year marked the finalization of a maritime border deal signed by Lebanon and Israel after more than a decade of on-off indirect talks. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. He also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue.
What happened in Nakara is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
Analysts believe Hezbollah made the right calculations in this move.
What stood out for me was the pragmatism exercised by Hezbollah in this particular agreement. It was very pragmatic in its approach, focusing, I think, first and foremost on Lebanon's economic interests, particularly with the dire economic situation. I think it was also a smart game played by Hezbollah, because I think that they believed deep down there was a conviction by the leadership that Biden couldn't afford another war and would prevent Israel from launching a war, even if Israel had a wish.
The deal is also seen as one of the major achievements of former President Michel Aoun, who stepped down in November without a successor. Now, while Lebanese lawmakers have so far failed to elect a new president, a caretaker cabinet remains in place since the parliamentary vote last spring, showing no sign of efforts to implement economic reforms.
As Lebanon ends the year 2022 without a president, observers are skeptical that any achievement concerning this file can be achieved soon. However, many believe that prospects for gas production and export are promising in the new year. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
According to the most recent statistics, there are now 4,760 Palestinian political prisoners in the Zionist regime's jails, with the Zionist regime enjoying huge support from the US and the European Union it faces no consequences for the abuse of prisoners. Apart from issuing timid statements of concern, the powerful allow the Zionist regime's cruelty to go unchallenged. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "Adjusting to reality outside the confines of an Israeli regime prison is not easy." Alian Al-Amour has found out that, "The sense of freedom I have now is strange," the 43-year-old said, adding, "When I walk, I find it hard to believe I can move without anyone stopping me." On the day after his release in September, Alian met his fiancée, Dina, for the first time. The couple got engaged while Alian was in prison, but Dina was never able to visit him. Alian and Dina married within a few weeks of their first meeting. It was an important step toward ensuring that Alian can rebuild his life. The horrors he encountered behind bars cannot be erased from his memory. His long period of detention began in September 2006. Alian was at home in Al-Fukhari near the Gaza city of Khan Yunus when Israeli regime troops invaded the area and arrested him. He was quickly brought to Ashkelon prison inside the occupied territories, where he was kept for 35 days. During that period, he was held underground and was repeatedly beaten and threatened by his Israeli interrogators. Alian believes that his interrogators wanted to coerce him into confessing to something he had not done. Over the next 3 years, Alian was brought to court on numerous occasions. He noted, "The bus used to transport him looked good on the outside, but inside there were iron bars, handcuffs, and armed troops." Although the trip to court should have been short, the Zionist regime authorities would often keep Alian handcuffed inside the bus for long periods. It was not unusual for Alian to be held in the bus for 3 full days as the drivers transported him and other Palestinians between the court and various prisons. 3 years after his trial began, Alian, who had worked in the Palestinian Authority's security forces, was sentenced to a lengthy jail term over allegations that he was involved in resistance activities. He spent a total of 16 years behind bars, mostly in Ramon prison. Throughout his time in jail, Alian was held in harsh conditions. As he was in reasonably good health, Alian was arguably a little more fortunate than other prisoners. He became increasingly conscious of how the conditions exacerbated the health problems of prisoners who were unwell. Alian wanted to help those with medical issues, yet for most of the time, all he was able to do was communicate with them remotely, via lawyers or by sending verbal messages when he met other prisoners on buses, heading to and from court, and offer some moral support. That changed in 2019. Early that year, he submitted a request to join a group of prisoners who work in Ramal Prison Clinic. His request was accepted by the authorities. Initially, he was excited by how he had an opportunity to do what he wanted. His excitement turned to shock as soon as he saw the cruelty inflicted on Palestinian patients in Ramel. He said, "It was like a slaughterhouse. I will never forget the sight of patients on my first day there. Their hands were cuffed to the beds. Their faces looked sad and exhausted. And I could see from thin bodies how severely ill they were. There was no doubt that the hospital was not taking care of them." Along with a few other prisoners, Alian assisted patients who required help to eat and take medicine or who had mobility issues. At times, he would raise patients' complaints with lawyers or with the clinic's administration. A number of patients Alian met in Rommel had cancer. The services offered to cancer patients were, he noted, completely inadequate. For chemotherapy and other essential treatments, cancer patients were transferred to hospitals that were larger. Once a week, guards at the Rommel clinic would carry out an inspection, generally at night time. During it, patients were moved to a yard for a number of hours, no matter what the weather was like. Prisoners with medical needs frequently faced an ordeal. The Israeli regime authorities can stall on processing prisoners' applications for hospital treatment. It is not uncommon, according to Alian, for 18 months or 2 years to elapse between an application for such treatment and a final decision. Sometimes the authorities reject requests, he said. There are hundreds of prisoners with health problems, but they are afraid of the Zionist hospitals because of the deliberate negligence. I haven't seen a patient get better in the hospital. The patients only leave in coffins. It is very sad. The three of Rommel's patients died in the few years that Alian worked in the clinic. Among them was Bassam Al-Say, 46, from Nablus, in the occupied West Bank. Al-Say had leukemia and died in September 2019. Bassam used to say, "I want to go back to Gaza with you and eat fish on the beach," Alian said. That was in the last few days of his life. I held back my tears and told him, "It would be wonderful if we could go to the beach in Gaza together." As well as visiting patients in Rommel Clinic, Alian reached out to some other prisoners who were ill. One of them, Sami Al-Amour, was a relative from Deir al-Balah in Gaza. Alian would send verbal messages to Sami via other prisoners. Last year, doctors recommended that Sami should have surgery for blocked arteries. But rather than being taken to hospital, Sami was kept in prison. Alian argued that keeping Sami in prison was tantamount to a death sentence. Alian added, they knew how critical his condition was. Sami died in Zionist regime custody during November last year. He was only 39. The horrors which Alian Al-Amour encountered have been witnessed by so many others. Meanwhile, Palestinian Wafa News Agency reported Mohammad Masrawa, 25, from Tulkarm, lost sight in his right eye after Israeli regime occupation troops assaulted him during his arrest at his family's house on January 20 of this year. They said the prisoners and ex-prisoners' affairs condition had reported this news. It said in a statement that Israeli regime troops assaulted Masrawa, currently in Israeli regime custody, with the rifle butts on his head and forehead, which caused a severe injury to the forehead that led to losing vision in his right eye. It said Masrawa was supposed to undergo an operation on his eye this month, but that the Zionist regime prison services cancelled the operation on the pretext that he is going to finish his sentence in April of next year, after serving a year and a half in prison for resisting the occupation. The commission said Masrawa suffers from severe stomach pains and that he was given medication for a short period before the prison clinic stopped it without any reason. Masrawa is a former prisoner who spent 20 months in the Zionist regime prisons.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
What are the biggest news stories to come out of the Palestinian occupied Palestinian territories? Maybe hard to answer that, but it shouldn't. Hard because mainstream Western media did not cover the daily killings, assassinations, home demolitions, illegal detentions, and Al-Aqsa mosque desecration. Well, the list is rather long, but in this edition of the Spotlight, we will review some of the important and noteworthy events covering Palestine and the Israeli regime and how the new administration, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, spells bad news for Palestinians for this new year. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mohsen Nahvi joins us. He's a human rights activist. Joins us from Houston, Texas. And Charlotte Cates, international coordinator of the Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joins us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mohsen Nahvi, let me first start with you. It was a toss-up in the list that I had between number one and two, and I must say the list was rather long. But I'm going to go with what I put as number two, but I think it should be number one, and that is the daily raids and killings that have happened in the occupied territories by Israeli regime forces. Really, the focus started to unfold starting in March when you saw what was called a Break the Wave military campaign by Israel. And they included these raids and mass arrests and killings. The focus was on the Jenin refugee camp and also in Nablus. And, of course, it amounted to a year that had the most Palestinian deaths, which was around 240, give or take. Why do you think this year marked the year for so many Palestinian deaths? And if you agree, if that should be the number one story coming out of the occupied territories.
Right, so Nablus is a very unique place. That's where we also have the Lion's Den and the famous Shaheed. The Lion of Nablus was also recently martyred by the Israeli regime. And the reason why there's such a huge focus on the West Bank and on these occupied territories, which technically are self-governed by the Palestinian Authority as per the UN resolution, is because primarily we see a wave of defense, a wave of retaliation from the resistance forces in the West Bank and the Jerusalem areas of occupied Palestine. And so to counter and to crush the morale of these resistance forces, which is obviously slightly different from the resistance that Israel has faced from Gaza, the Israeli regime seems to have a focus on West Bank to really kill the morale of the Palestinians who are living in those areas, and to really somehow to really crush the resistance forces that are rising up in occupied Palestine, in Jenin, in West Bank. And it is, and I'm sure you're going to cover this in this talk further as well, that this is in clear contradiction to the intent of the United Nations. That goes on to also show that the that the Zionist regime has no respect of international law. They have no respect of the United Nations even.
But looking at one particular incident, Charlotte Cates, you had 10 Palestinians that were killed by Israeli security forces in a matter of one day. And then you had the European Union foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, come out saying that, you know, he's greatly concerned about the increasing level of violence in the occupied West Bank. So my thing is, first of all, when you have 10 deaths in one day, if I were to say that, or you were to say that to any common person, perhaps, they would not even be aware that that happened, maybe. At the same time, when you have the EU foreign policy chief making a statement like that, it shows the divergence that has kind of been the custom. Condemn something, and the next day probably is not even aware that he did come out and say that, because that's just the thing to do when we're talking about Palestinian lives. Why do you think that is?
Well, the fact is that the European Union, just like the United States, Canada, Australia, and other imperialist powers, are aligned with the interest of continuing to perpetuate a Zionist occupation in Palestine and affecting and providing essentially a military base for imperialism in the region. And so, you know, the European Union, if it was serious about actually taking some kind of action to put a brake on this ongoing onslaught of war crimes and crimes against humanity and extrajudicial killings and mass imprisonment, not to mention the installation of this openly fascist government in the Zionist regime, then they would do something like impose sanctions on the Israeli occupation regime. After all, we see the European Union and the United States not hesitating to impose sanctions on peoples and countries around the world who are simply defending their own right to self-determination and independence. But instead, in the case of the Israeli occupation, we see the European Union rewarding Israel with access to funding, with access to research and development funds, and with preferential treatment through the EU-Israel Association Agreement for Trade. So the European Union has set itself up as a full partner in these crimes of the occupation against the Palestinian people. This does not actually reflect, by and large, the views of the population in Europe. What it does is it reflects the interests of imperialism instead. And, you know, that disconnect is why we're actually seeing a growing level of activism and mobilization to demand the boycott and isolation of Israel, and especially among young Palestinians in the diaspora, who are a growing population in Europe.
One of those deaths out of the around 240, Mohsen Naqvi, was one that made the news, and it made the news in a big way. And that was the assassination that I'm going to call of the Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The footage that came initially that showed what happened, well, it didn't show what happened. It was the aftermath. But then they actually had the reenactment that was done. And beyond a shadow of a doubt, it showed that, you know, that Israeli sniper targeted Shireen Abu Akleh. Where do things stand now regarding that? I mean, you had Israel whitewash it. You had the U.S. back Israel. And they said that that investigation was not, in their eyes, 100% complete in accusing the Israeli sniper to have committed that crime. Again, it shows another case where Israel gets away with it. Why do you think Israel gets away with it?
Well, first of all, this is not the first time that Israel has committed the crime of knowingly and intentionally killing a journalist. It's quite clear from all the evidences that are now available that the sniper definitely knew exactly that he was targeting a member of the press, a journalist. Yet there seems to be no repercussions against the Zionist entity. It's quite clear now that over the past years we've seen that the United Nations is biased. We've seen that countries who claim to be so-called flag bearers of human rights always tend to ignore the violations of the Zionist regime, the violation that the Zionist regime commits against the innocent Palestinians. So obviously this was big, this news was big, but then the silence of mainstream media, even, for instance, it's absolutely despicable. And I would really go on to really reiterate the fact that mainstream media outlets remain silent, but then other media outlets on social media or TV channels such as Press TV, when they come out and present these kind of news or other news outlets that tend to commit to present these news that aren't available on mainstream media, for some reason, they start getting banned on in different countries. They start getting banned on social media. Their channels start getting banned. So clearly, it's an extremely obvious roadmap to how mainstream media and the powers to be are trying to censor independent voices. And one way by killing innocent journalists.
Yeah, I'm sorry to have interrupted you there. There is a notion out there, perhaps, Charlotte Cates, that Israel may be having a point in terms of not being completely guilty, whether it's from the assassination of Shirin Abu Akhle or when Palestinians are killed. But correct me if I'm wrong, and I finally brought up what I was looking for, which was roughly, well, I'll give you a date on this. This is going back to the beginning of the year. When the then Prime Minister, I'm not too sure how many Prime Ministers Israel has had, there's so many, but the then Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, actually, after there was an attack in Tel Aviv that killed three Israelis, he said to the security forces that you can have the full freedom to act after that happens. Full freedom, which is one out of many cases where, from the top down, there are orders that are given to kill Palestinians. I think another great example of that would be the right of return, where Palestinians were targeted and the Israeli forces were given carte blanche to target them. Not only medics didn't escape that, but also journalists. Is there any doubt as to orders coming from the top down to kill Palestinians?
Yeah, these are not isolated one-off incidents. It's not the case where every single day there's another isolated incident, whether it's the assassination of Shirin Abu Akhle, whether it's the killing of Palestinian children, whether it's the torture of Palestinian prisoners like Samer Abid. These are not isolated acts that are committed by one bad apple. These are part and parcel of Zionist policy, and they have been for 75 years. It's nothing new in many ways. I mean, what we're looking at is these are not just isolated incidents that happen separately from one another, but are part of a process of an ongoing Nakba that has been taking place in occupied Palestine since 1947, 1948, and really before that, through Zionist colonialism sponsored by British colonialism. There's an imperialist war on the Palestinian people and a settler colonial project that is built on attempting to take more and more Palestinian land and displace more and more Palestinian people. And so all of these crimes are part of the Zionist project itself, not a deviation from it.
Sure. Well, the Zionist project has many projects, and I think one of them is one of the ones that are probably one of the oldest, but is continuing. And not really a word is said about it, Mohsen Naghvi. It's quite amazing, and that is the siege on Gaza from the year 2007 up to now. What is that, 16 years at this point? I mean, they do call it an open-air prison, but maybe Israel wants it that way. Why do you think that doesn't get coverage the way that it should? And at this point, when you have all these Palestinians that are locked in there, so to speak, what are the gains that Israel has? Unless its purpose is hoping, which it hasn't happened, for the democratically elected government ruling there of Hamas to be overthrown by the people within, which, again, there are no signs of that happening.
You see, the tactics that are used by bullies is to instill fear. The only way that a bully can remain in power is if they instill fear in the minds of the people. And clearly, Israel has miserably failed. And the first time that their tactics were failed openly and were recognized by the international community was when they lost to Hezbollah in 2000 and then miserably lost again in 2006. It is then that the spider's web was truly unveiled, and Israel came out as a very weak entity in West Asia. And I feel countries like Syria, countries like Palestine, Iraq, Iran, for instance, they have proven to the world that Israel has become weak. Israel doesn't have any power. The role that Israel has played as the policeman on behalf of the West in that region, they have failed to do so. And now Gaza is a prison, yes, but Hamas is a popular government, a successful popular government within that region. They have armed themselves, and they are resisting now. They're resisting with missiles. And it's a shame on the Arab leaders, on the UAE. It's a shame on Saudi Arabia that they still want to go and they want to shake hands and they want to recognize Israel as a nation when innocent Muslim Palestinians, Christian Palestinians are being miserably killed by the Zionist entity. Every single maneuver that the UK, the US, the Zionist regime have tried has miserably failed. And now this is the last nail that they have formed a government with extremist fascists under Benjamin Netanyahu, under Bibi. And the UN resolution talks about giving self-determination to occupied Palestine. And then right after that, in the recent elections, and we see people like Ben-Gavir literally running the politics of Israel. So one can only imagine the atrocities that one will face. But as I've mentioned before, that these atrocities will only give a rise to the defense forces and to the retaliation that will come from the resistance forces against the Zionist regime, and it will make them weaker than before.
Yeah, there was a number of topics there, Charlotte Cates, that Mohsen Naqvi touched on. And I guess I'm going to go with the UNGA resolution, which made a case to refer Israel to the ICJ. I mean, that sounds great, doesn't it? But Israel is not a signatory to the ICC. Israel, at the same time, the UNGA does not have in its charter any type of enforcement that it can do over Israel in terms of even a cooperation. So that's just good on paper. Really, that's what that is. It's good that it's getting highlighted. But how are you going to have anything really happen on the ground to change the facts?
Well, one of the things that's been the case, especially with the referrals to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, has been that there has been a tremendous amount of pressure exerted by the Western powers in order for even this very limited mechanism to be reduced even further, for its ability to actually do anything about the Zionist war crimes actually kind of limited even further. And so we're seeing, for example, from the British Prime Minister, from the Germans, from the United States and elsewhere, a concerted policy to actually block the ICC. And note, of course, all of these countries are also countries that refuse to be held accountable for their imperial crimes at the International Criminal Court as well. Indeed. Because instead they want to preserve these international mechanisms as actually simply a place where the imperialist powers can drag leaders of nations that refuse to bow down to the dictates of imperialism before them. So there's not really an intention of having justice here. I mean, of course, at the ICJ, the International Court of Justice in 2004, we saw that there was already a ruling about the illegality of the apartheid wall. This was 19 years ago now. And so now there's another referral for an occupation and colonial project that's been happening for over 75 years. While it can be worthwhile to fight in the courts, we know that it's actually the Palestinian resistance that is changing the balance of power and posing a real challenge to Zionist control of Palestine and to the Israeli occupation. And so we see that even these kinds of purely legal mechanisms that are simply based on, you know, standard tenets of international law are viewed as completely unacceptable forms of resistance. So when even going to court is viewed as a form of terror and labeled as such by the Israeli occupation regime, I mean, we can see that they've labeled multiple organizations that are essentially Palestinian lawyers organizations working to bring some kind of justice, that there's no alternative for the Palestinian people but to resist by all means that are necessary and available to them.
We got just a few minutes time, and we got so many more topics to cover here. I'm going to go with one that I believe needs to be highlighted, Mohsen Naqvi. This is how an incident is covered by mainstream media, such as the UK-funded BBC or CNN, which is obviously carrying the U.S. line. It said, in this case, CNN, the Palestinian Health Ministry said that at least 10 people were killed, including a 5-year-old girl and a 23-year-old woman. Another 75 were injured. And then it says Israel insists most of those killed were militants. So you're getting this incident covered in the way that it is, but putting that last sentence in there so that it covers the fact that you had 10 people that were killed, and one of them was a 5-year-old girl.
Right.
Is the narrative that Israel, with its influence on the media, have any buyers out there, even now, after all the crimes that they have committed?
Well, this is, and the example that you've given is one. When we bring in Hollywood, when we bring in the TV shows that are shown in the West, the Arabs are portrayed as militants. The average Arab is portrayed as a militant, as someone who is a hijacker, who hijacks planes, is a terrorist. That's the narrative that has been built, right? And to add that word militant changes the entire context of that news. And this is exactly this the word game that the Zionist regime has been playing through its stooges. Stooges like the owner of Sky News, stooges like the Rothschilds, who have always given a narrative that supports the Zionist line. And this is exactly what we see when Sheikh Qasem Soleimani was martyred. A sitting general of a sovereign nation is killed in a sovereign country by an outside force, and the entire mainstream media remains silent. Not one word of criticism. What if something like this would have happened to a general within the Zionist entity? One can only imagine what BBC and CNN would have said.
Sure.
So the bias is clear now. The bias is clear. International law has failed. The United Nations has failed.
There's all right, no last question. Last question, Charlotte Case, goes to you. There has been a growing Palestinian armed resistance that has happened, and we have seen this past year for that to be emboldened through their acts. And I must say that they're not related to any of the resistance groups. They seem to be just homegrown, or they've concocted their own group out of obviously the frustration that they're having based on the occupation and their rights being violated. And these new groups, again, refuse to align themselves with any specific party or movement. We saw, for example, the twin bombing that happened was a pretty, in Al-Quds, was a pretty intensive and complicated operation. Do you think that that is going to increase this coming year and maybe take the form of one kind or another of another intifada?
One thing that I just want to note, that all of the Palestinian resistance organizations are part and parcel of the Palestinian people and are created and sustained through the sacrifice and commitment of Palestinians to fight for liberation. And so, of course, it is only natural that Palestinians will continue to create and evolve organizations that are engaged in resistance, to build united fronts and a united resistance front, bringing together those that are engaged in resistance from different political trends.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic.